It's a line in the sand. You cross it, nothing happens. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
And it's good to be back with you here for the second day in a row. Technical glitches do happen, ladies and gentlemen. And when a computer that you're recording a program on goes blue screen on you, you usually don't get to keep the file, and we didn't get to keep the file, but luckily we were only about 15 minutes into it.
So, ladies and gentlemen, before you get nervous and start reaching for your dial thinking this is another one of those pledge drives that public radio does, number one, this is private radio, and number two, we will take your donations, we're not out here asking you for them. So.
No, and unlike PBS... We're not a tax exempt organization, we're not deductible.
Yeah, and we're tax averse. Let's just put it that way. Now, it's interesting that we brought up donations and taxes, Chuck, because that's what we're going to be talking about today. And really, I want to start with some numbers. I want to start with some numbers that I hope that our listeners who are driving will put both hands on the wheel for and. Get ready, because these numbers might send you into some kind of shock. So, right now, Charles.
Well, I'm going to disagree with that for a second.
Okay. That's true.
The numbers that we're talking about are so bizarrely large that it's incomprehensible how much money this really is.
And because of the way it's reported, all we're seeing is a slice of it, and that slice is big enough. But then if you understand the crazy world of government finance, you start realizing that that slice is only about, a 12th of what we're actually looking at in the whole pie. And what we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is the debt of the United States of America. Now, there's different kinds of debt, and we've talked a little bit about this on other programs. The debt numbers that you hear on the nightly news and see in the newspapers and, well, even on most of the blog sites, which is what we're going to be talking about today, is talking about the on-book current debt of the United States. Now, we know that right now, Charles, that debt is somewhere in the neighborhood of $17.5 trillion. That's trillion with a T, ladies and gentlemen. That means there's what? 12 zeros after the one. Six in a million, 9 in a billion, 12 in a trillion.
12 in a trillion.
So it'd be 12 zeros after the 17.
Right.
Okay. So that's the numbers we're talking about. So over $17 trillion.
It's 1 times 10 to the 12th for those of you who are trained in scientific notation.
Oh, actually, and I got this note here from a web source. As of the 10th of February, and we're recording this on the 13th, so as of 3 days ago, the actual debt, now that's the debt of the federal government, the on-book debt, is $17,258,793,918,103.22.
That's a snapshot number.
That's a snapshot number. But you know what? I'll tell you what. I'm going to do my fair share today, Chuck. I'm going to send 22 cents into the federal government.
Yeah.
Well, now, they're going to be asking me for a lot more come April 15th.
You're going to do that anyway.
I'm going to do that anyway. That's right. That's
Think about that this way. That's the on-book debt. We have talked on this program several times about the true debt.
About the true debt, which is the total debt load, which counts all indebtedness, both in GRF monies and
explain what GRF is.
That's General Revenue Fund. In other words, that's the current budget deficits, and in long-term borrowing obligations and general obligation bonds, which when they mature and are cash back in, we have to pay back to the holders, mainly China and other foreign nationals, with interest. Now, an economist at Boston University, and we talked about this on an earlier program, which we'll link to from this program so you can go back and listen to it without having to search when you go to our website at principledpolicy.com. An economist from Boston University looks at those numbers and has done so for almost two decades, and he pegs our true debt at $205 trillion. That's instead of 17 with 12 zeros, 205 with 12 zeros behind it, yeah. Which is a magnitude of about 12 times that $17 trillion figure.
Right. So the real numbers are much larger. And in fact, that's the part that when we were testifying on the constitutional convention call in Ohio for a balanced budget amendment, we basically both said it's a pipe dream. You can't balance a budget with a deficit of $205 trillion in it by cutting a little spending here and a little spending there.
Well, especially not if you're coupling the spending cuts to new increases,
yes,
in spending.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is what and we're going to talk about this a little bit more in this program a little bit later. There's a term for that kind of gamesmanship and playing with these budget numbers that's named after a certain politician of whom you and I both have our own opinions on. But
yes,
we're going to talk about him in a little bit. Okay, now Chuck, the thing is, we all know what that debt number is right now. The thing that I'm looking at from this article in CNSNews.com by Terrence Jeffrey, who we've referenced on this program before because he does pretty good research. Do you know that our debt in 2011, before the first round of debt increases, the debt ceiling cap lifts were allowed by our federal government, under this current regime, you know, with Obama administration in the executive branch and with our friends John Boehner and Harry Reid leading the House and the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the House is where all budget appropriations has to start.
So guess who
has to shoulder the responsibility for this initially?
John Boehner.
Do you know how much our debt was? I mean, it wasn't pretty then either. But just less than 2.5 years ago, Chuck, our debt was $704,743,080.97. Okay, that's an increase of $2,678,089,175,022.25. Now they're starting to talk about numbers I can recognize. 25 cents.
Yeah.
because I don't even know if we're going to have two quarters to rub together once this current regime cycle is over with. Now, folks, $2.678 trillion increase in 2.5 years. That comes out to a rate of $1,071 billion and change per year of increased debt. And Terrence Jeffrey does us a good service in this article, Chuck. He keeps working this out. He says that works out to an average of approximately $9,315 in new federal debt per year for each of the approximately 115,006,000 households the Census Bureau estimates are in the country. Okay, each household every year has an increase in the debt that they have to show, that ultimately we have to shoulder, because remember, ladies and gentlemen, the government doesn't make money. They just take money and redistribute it.
They claim they make money.
Who makes the money? You and I.
We do.
It's called our labor. It's called trading our labor for remuneration, or being creative and productive and producing a good or a service that is in demand that someone else will pay for in a free market system. Government, all they can do is corrupt the free market system, take away from people their ability to do those creative and those productive things, and then redistribute it to their favored directions they want to go.
And which are becoming increasingly more, and you hear the phraseology. It's not about, it used to be that they talked in coded words about creating opportunity. No one is talking about creating opportunity
anymore.
Well,
now we call it stimulating the economy, and I'm not even sure they're using that phrase anymore.
Well, especially on the left, what they're talking now about is it direct Marxism, and that is redistributing wealth.
Yeah, well, that's because they think that they basically have a coup, and we're going to talk about how they might be right here in just a few
minutes. Yeah, they might be.
Okay, so right now, folks, under a Republican-controlled House where all budgets have to start, in the last 2 years and 6 months, we have had an almost $2.7 trillion increase in our debt. Folks, let's think about this. Can you, ladies and gentlemen, mom and dad out there, Joe and Jane homeowner, can you, at your current rate of income, afford to tack on another $9,315 in spending every year for the next 2.5 years without your income changing? Can you do that? I would say the answer is probably not.
No. Yeah, another $10,000 out of your pocket.
About a $10,000 a year out of your pocket that you have no control over.
Over and above the taxes.
Yes, because remember, we're only talking about the on-book current budget site debt. We're not talking about the true debt. Multiply that number by 12.
Well, okay, think about this. We've got the new head of the Fed. Whose name is
Janet Yellen?
Yellen.
Yeah, well, it almost sounds Russian, but
Yeah, well, it probably is,
but nonetheless,
she's talking about I'll print money all day long. Well, what does that mean?
Inflationary cycles. And, that's what that means.
Well, who's buying the bonds?
China.
No, they're not.
First of all, the Fed's buying their own bonds.
Exactly.
They're issuing and then buying them back so that they can play fast and loose with two sets of books.
Yeah. So probably right now, I think. Now, I read this and I don't have the article in front of me. But right now, I think the Fed is actually the biggest debt holder in the world.
And remember, folks, the Fed is not a government agency.
No.
They're private.
Right.
They're treated as a quasi-governmental agency.
They are a quasi-government corporation.
Yes.
Sort of like PBS.
Right. And we all know how well that works.
Well, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And you can name a whole bunch of these quasi-government corporations that supposedly do this, that, or another thing and are supposedly private. But they're kind of private and they're kind of government and they're in this never-never land.
The U.S. Postal Service?
Well... Yeah, well, let's not go into that. But the fact is that basically the Fed is buying up these bonds. Now, I'm going to use an example that I used in our Constitution class last week, and that is the Joseph example.
Okay, very good.
The Joseph example in Genesis. What did Joseph do? Well, he has the dream about the that basically he interprets
the skinny cows and the fat cows.
And the skinny cows eat up the fat cows.
Yeah, okay. Seven years of famine, 7 years of prosperity.
So what does Joseph do? He sees this coming and he has the Pharaoh institute a 20%, which is basically a confiscatory tax structure.
Sure.
And they take in a 20% tax of everything that's produced.
Right.
To put in storage. So they put all this in storage.
Grain, et cetera.
Et cetera, because he is given by the Holy Spirit, is given the interpretation of the dream as meaning that a 7-year drought is coming. Okay, so what happens during this 7-year drought? Well, at first, they take all this grain that has been confiscated by government taxation.
Yep.
And then they start to sell it back to the people.
Right.
So the grain that was theirs to start with, they have to buy.
So then, when they run out of money...
Yeah, then they go to cattle...
Yeah, they go to their property.
They go to their property, cattle, property...
And then ultimately they get to their land that they held, and so therefore Pharaoh, the government, ends up...
Owning all the land.
Owning the land, and then there's only one thing left, and you're still in a famine period, and you're starving, and you need to provide, so what's the only thing you got left to give to the government?
Yourself.
Slavery.
Yes.
That's right.
Now, they will be very gracious in not calling it that.
Bond servitude. Then.
Bond servitude. And essentially, that is what we're going toward. And from a biblical example, we are going, and it looks like we're in a time of plenty.
I don't think that's quite true. I think there's a lot of it. It's like a man in the desert, Charles. You're out in the desert, and you don't have a camel. You've lost your camel. And we all know the camel's now disproved the Bible, but we're going to talk about that another program.
That's a different program.
That's a different program. You've lost your camel. Your wineskin is dry. The sun's beating down. You're crawling. What do you see off in the distance? Water! And so you get that burst of energy and you crawl to your salvation, which becomes
a mirage. Yes, it's a mirage.
Yes, an illusion. I think this idea that we're in this time of fatness is like that mirage out there. It's an illusion. And the closer we get to where we're going to have to pay the piper, the more we're going to realize that was all an illusion. You know, you take a look at what's going on out there, Charles. We have 93 million Americans who are so far out of employment, they're even off the unemployment records.
Right. They not only went through their 99 weeks, they're well beyond that, and they've stopped looking and have gone on relief.
Over 30% of the American population is what we would consider chronically unemployed. Now, Charles, in a country where we prize entrepreneurship and risk-taking and, you know, success and pulling ourselves up by the bootstraps, if you want to use that whole Horatio Alger, fantasy. Dude, the bootstraps are broken.
Well, they're not broken. They've been cut.
They've been cut and boiled for food. That's what we're getting into, really. And that's hypothetically, of course, ladies and gentlemen. But the key is the indicators are not good, Charles.
No.
And when you're sitting here saying that our government, the emperors who really have no clothes, have bumped. Now, this is from the time John Boehner capitulated the first time,
right,
on pushing the debt ceiling higher and not reining in government spending in any real way. Now, behold, with the sequester and we shut down government. No, we didn't. We sent government on a paid vacation for 3 weeks and then brought them back.
A very few government employees got basically a 3-week vacation.
Right, and they all got paid back.
And
got paid their back pay.
Yeah, they all got paid.
So let's stop talking about slowdowns and shutdowns. What we did was we gave them 3 weeks vacation with pay. So what did they do to reward us? Oh, we're going to increase the debt ceiling again. So last spring, hey, we're up another $1 trillion. Remember, they were wanting six, but they only pushed it up a trillion. And we knew we were going to have to come back at the beginning of the year. Charles, we knew it. We even heard House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan talking with his Democratic counterparts, and this was reported in the press, and I think we talked about it on a program, who basically said spending cuts are off the table. And we're okay with increasing spending. If we can only get, you know, because we're going to use that to get all of these concessions, right? That's what was said last summer and into the fall. Well, ladies and gentlemen, like I said, under John Boehner, since August of 2011, when the first debt ceiling bump went into effect, and we started down this slippery slope, this roller coaster ride that has no brakes on it and really has no stopping point, $2.67 trillion in spending increases. Oh, but somebody said, well, they cut this and they cut food stamps. They did it. Blarney.
Yeah.
They may have taken money from one program, but they designed three others and funded them with it that basically do the same thing. That's sleight of hand in the federal and state government.
Okay, it's three-card Monty. Where's the queen?
Three-card Monty. Where's the queen? That's right.
Where's the queen? Actually, the queen is up the... up the illusionist sleeve. The queen isn't even anywhere in the stack. Yeah. That's the whole point. This is robbing Peter to pay Paul, except as we talked about at one point yesterday when what we lost, we don't like to use that metaphor because everybody's getting, both Peter and Paul are being robbed.
That's right. I said robbing from one thief to pay the other one. That's what we're doing.
To pay the other one.
But here's what we did, ladies and gentlemen, in probably a very historic vote, and I hope it's historic by it being the straw that finally broke the camel's back in Congress and will get John Boehner out of the speakership where he doesn't deserve to be. John Boehner presided over corralling 28 Republican votes, mainly from the House leadership, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, and others, and from the Republican members of the House Appropriations Committee, all who have chairmanships of subcommittees, what we call the College of Cardinals in Congress, and require them to vote for what is called a clean debt ceiling bill. Now, the word clean is somewhat of a misnomer because it's probably one of the dirtiest things you could do to the American taxpayer. What we've done, what John Boehner and 28 Republicans, along with over 200 Democrats, have done is they reached across the aisle, got votes from pretty much all but two of the Democrats. Now, in the House, the Republicans have the majority. All the Democrats except two voted in favor of this. Boehner corralled 27 of his Republican colleagues who owe him dearly.
Their jobs.
Owe him their livelihoods, yeah. And I do mean lively.
Well, explain that.
Well, okay, when you're on the Finance and Appropriations Committee, that's the most powerful committee in Congress. That's the one where all the superpower lobbyists go to make sure that their client interests get served, i.e. by taxpayer dollars. And then those members are what we call bankers because they get lots and lots of campaign cash from these same lobbyists on K Street. And that's the reason why they're the Cardinals, because they will bless or curse other members of the caucus and candidates who they want or don't want to be successful with their money.
There's another term that you said cardinals and bankers. They're bagmen.
Bagmen. Well, okay. Yeah, I didn't want to be quite that that coarse about it. But
I'm being cynical.
That's okay.
They're bagmen.
Okay.
They make sure that the money gets distributed, and if you don't toe the line, you don't get campaign money.
Well, that's it. And well, the point is, it looks like they're going to have awful lot of money, maybe not, to spend among their 28, because nobody else in the Republican caucus went along with them. The vote was 221 to 201. Now, I said two Democrats voted against it, so that meant 198 Republican members of Congress said no. Some of them on principle, some of them. I don't think so much on principle. We're going to talk about him in a little bit. Yes. I was for it before I was against it guy.
Yeah.
We'll talk about him in a minute. But the point is, it was John Boehner who forced this vote. It was John Boehner who required his key leaders to vote yes on this clean debt ceiling bill. Now, let me tell you what clean means. Clean means that the Obama administration gets to raise the debt, i.e., spend whatever they want to really spend, because there was no cap, ladies and gentlemen. There was no ceiling until March 15th of 2015.
The Ides of March.
Which is funny. They pushed it out beyond the midterm elections. Ah, well, uh-huh. Look at that. So they just handed the Obama administration a blank checkbook right around the congressional midterms that all the Democrats except two supported. And I saw a picture of Nancy Pelosi coming up and giving John Boehner a kiss on the cheek and telling her own caucus not to gloat and do victory dances yet. Okay, ladies and gentlemen? John Boehner just handed the Democrats the means to kick the Republicans out of the majority in the House, because a clean debt ceiling bill means you can increase the debt and there are no concomitant spending cuts that will be made. There's nothing it's linked to. There were no concessions. There is no Keystone XL pipeline approval by the administration. There is no lessening of regulatory nightmares upon the coal industry or upon anybody else for that matter. There was nothing. Now, Boehner says that the reason why was because all that 198 just wouldn't stand up and do what was right. I think it was because John Boehner doesn't have a spine anymore and likes his dinners at the White House more than he likes being a true leader of the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives.
Well,
and I know that's strong.
Yeah.
Prove me wrong, John. Prove me wrong.
Yeah. Stand up and do something.
Stand up and do something.
And stop getting kicked around like a soccer ball.
Right. Now, the House passed this bill on Tuesday and kicked it over to the Senate. And the Senate yesterday voted it with a vote of 55 to 43. Well, remember, the Senate is controlled by the Democrats. Harry Reid is the majority leader in the Senate. It's controlled by the Democrats in about those numbers. Now, an interesting thing is that Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, tried to filibuster, basically, to keep the vote from happening. And he was defeated because the Senate Democrats, of whom I believe there are 58, were able to invoke cloture, which takes a supermajority of 60 votes of the 100 votes in the Senate. So in other words, three-fifths, because two Republican senators crossed the lines and voted with the Democrats to allow cloture, which means debate has to stop and the vote has to be taken. Chuck, you know it. I wonder if our listeners know it. I'm sure they could almost guess who one of the two senators were. They probably never heard of the other one. And the votes for cloture, two Republicans had to come over in order to get those 60 votes. The two Republicans were one everybody's heard of. As a matter of fact, you're hearing a lot about him now because, well, he's in a re-election fight.
And kind of an ugly one.
Kind of a very ugly one. And he happens to be the Senate Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell, Senator from Kentucky. Huh. What is he trying to do? Mimic a Democrat so that the Democrat won't have something to run against him on? I wonder about that.
Well, he's thumbing his nose, at the Tea Party.
Well, that's true.
He thinks he's invincible.
Right.
And he may be right because the guy who's running against him, Matt Blevin, I think.
Bevin. Matt Bevin. Yeah.
Matt Bevin is mounting a pretty decent fight, but let's face it, he's got an uphill battle. And it looks like McConnell's probably going to pull that one out, unfortunately, when you look at stuff like this. Because people aren't paying really close attention to this kind of stuff. As we've talked about earlier in this program, one of the problems that people are having is that these numbers are so huge, and the constant fight over them people get numb, and they stop listening.
They stop listening.
So we're flapping our gums and nobody's going to listen, but the fact is we got to get the word out there and try to boil it down into something that people can understand, because that's an issue.
Yeah, it is.
And people don't understand what's going on. They just think, well, these guys know what they're doing, and these guys are quote-unquote conservative, so it must be okay. No, they don't know what they're doing.
No, they don't.
They're listening to quote-unquote economic advisors who have subscribed to a false system of economy, and they are essentially destroying the country. So that's where guys like Mitch McConnell are coming from. Now, you wanted to go someplace else with someone else who's got a similar situation, and that was John Cornyn of Texas. And he's got a primary challenge from the Tea Party, although, again, the guy who's challenging him from the Tea Party is a congressman who's doing a terrible job. It's almost like he's throwing the match. He disappeared for...
Oh, a Manchurian candidate?
Or a dummy.
Or a dummy.
Who's out there to essentially, he's a stalking horse.
Yes.
And because he disappeared for like 10 days. Nobody could find him. He's in the middle of this uphill battle running against John Cornyn of Texas. And I can't think of his name, darn it.
I'd have to do some research on that.
But anyway,
I apologize.
He disappears for several days. And turns out he was in Russia doing some research while he's in the middle of an uphill battle in a primary campaign. And the Tea Party people in Texas are all going, what are you doing?
Can you say rookie?
Yeah, or stalking horse.
Or stalking horse. Yeah, that's true. But so basically the Senate passed this debt ceiling increase. Now, I think they tried to salve their conscience, Chuck, because there was an analysis by the Senate Budget Committee Republican staff that honestly I think is almost singing a Pied Piper's tune. Their prediction is the national debt will only rise to $18.2 trillion while the debt limit is suspended. Okay. Right now, what did I say earlier? We were at 17.2. They think it's only going to go up $1 trillion in the next 13 months.
Hold on. Only $1 trillion.
Only $1 trillion.
Yeah, so that's only about $8,000, $7,500.
Now, remember, we said for every roundabout $1 trillion that was increased per year, which is about a year, it was almost $10,000 per household debt load increase.
Yeah.
So they're okay with every household in the United States having another $10,000 on top of the almost $30,000 that they've been given since 2011. So that's $40,000 of increases in 4 years, Chuck.
Inside 12 months.
No, excuse me. Well, no, counting from 2011, August of 2011 to March of 2015.
Oh, you're right.
3.5 years, $40,000 in increased debt for every household. Now, remember, many of those households, their incomes are not going up. As a matter of fact, with the implementation of the Unaffordable Care Act, Obamacare, now you got to pay more for your health care coverage. Really? I thought we were all supposed to be able to keep your same plans. Yeah, exactly. No, that didn't work.
It's going to save us money.
But now they got $40,000 in encumbered debt increases just on the on-book stuff. Ladies and gentlemen, can you afford 40? If I said from starting right now, your salary you got in and everything that you're spending right now, we're going to throw another $40,000 of debt onto you in the next 3.5 years, how are you going to pay for it? How are you going to pay for it? Well, you're going to take another job, work two jobs, three jobs? What about your wife? How about those kids? You know, you got a kid who's getting close. Maybe we put him out there to work. Oh, maybe we get rid of a vehicle. Well, we only have two, so I guess we're going to have one now. Then if I'm working three jobs, then how are we going to get to and from things that we need to do? Oh, I guess, kids, you're going to have to cut those out. Honey, you're going to have to cut those events out. Start sewing because, you know, clothing. Yeah, we're going to just have to, like, we're not buying new school clothes for the kids this fall. And eating out? No, we're going to cut that out. Movies? No, can't do those now either. What about our vacation? Well, we're going to do staycations, and it's not going to be cation. It's going to be I'm going to pick up some extra work on the side during that week.
Yeah.
Folks, that's what we're dealing with because we're not the federal government. We don't have printing presses in our basements. We don't have stamping machines at West Point that can stamp coinage that's basically valueless. And throw it out there, or as we talked about just a minute ago, Janet Yellen saying, oh, I'll just print more money. Janet, when you put more bad money into circulation, all it does is devalue that money, makes it harder to get by on what you have because the prices of everything start going up, and it's an increasing debt inflation spiral.
I can tell you that we're beginning to see that now from my business. Now, what's happening in a lot of cases is a lot of companies are eating the increases and cutting their profit margins in order to attempt to keep the prices down. That can't last.
You can only do that so long.
We've already had very large price increases, and it's due to raw material shortages because of government meddling in different parts of the market. I tried to explain this in our class. I think most of our class members got it. We had a couple who just couldn't quite grasp the concept that you can't control one part of a market and not have something go out of control in another part of the market.
It's
impossible. You can hold down costs in one place, and it's like whack-a-mole. You whack the mole, another mole pops up over here, or maybe three moles pop up over here. The more you meddle with it, the more out of balance it becomes. And that's the situation we're essentially in right now, and we're really meddling with it now. Now, we were talking at lunch earlier. What's going on in response? For instance, I'm seeing things about how Wall Street has been watching the debt ceiling, these debt ceiling debates, and what are we seeing from what's happening? Well, what's happening to the price of gold?
So, it's starting to climb again.
Yes.
It's been hovering around a certain level for a couple months now. And I do that because I kind of keep a daily track on what's going on in the metals markets. In the last week, it has started taking $30, $40, $50 jumps up. And now it's up over $1,300 an ounce. It was sitting around almost just above $1,200 in the last week and a half. So, folks, there's a movement. And why? People are buying it and taking it all out of the market because they don't have any confidence in anything else, whether it be bonds or stocks.
Well, let me ask you, you mentioned this. What happened after this whole vote? What did everybody dump and pick up?
Everybody started dumping stocks and started picking up government bonds.
Yeah.
Because if there is no spending cuts or caps on a clean debt increase bill, that means if you buy your bonds right now, they're forced to pay you back at some point with all the interest. They won't be capping them. They won't say you can only take so much, or we're going to have to cap the rate, you know, or we're going to try to buy them back early and, you know, and work out some deals on off books, or what the Fed has been doing. Oh, we're going to buy back $6 billion in bonds and put out $8 billion more, which would then we're going to buy $7 billion of that back. So,
yeah,
you know, it's, Chuck, I'm going to use the term Ponzi scheme.
Sure it is.
But the problem is, the American taxpayer is the poor sucker who put the money up in the first place.
Well, and okay, let's put it this way. Yeah, he's putting the money up, but it's because there's a gun in his back. And it's in the hands of the Internal Revenue Service.
Yes, it is.
So the fact is that that's called robbery. You're being stolen from. And you're being stolen from in two different ways, because as everyone who pays attention to this knows, especially the Austrian economists, inflation is a tax. If you think about how inflation comes about, I still marvel at people who say that inflation is the fault of the middleman. Oh, so if we cut the middleman out, the guy who does the distribution, then suddenly our prices are all going to get better? No.
No, they're not.
Because those are the guys who warehouse it, who pay the cost of warehousing that material so that you're not doing start and stop manufacturing.
Uh-huh.
Because if you start manufacturing on demand items, what happens to the cost?
Well, if it's on demand, then it's custom, which means the cost is going to be much greater.
Significantly greater. So what happens is you get workers who you say, well, you know, there's no work today because we don't have any orders. We're anticipating an order tomorrow or maybe the next day, so we'll call you when we want you to come into work. It creates a ripple effect throughout the economy that essentially skyrockets costs.
Yes, it does.
And it also, while those costs are skyrocketing, people who suddenly aren't working all the time,
yep,
don't have the money to buy things.
That's right.
And so they go off to buying necessities. Again, this is that ripple effect that people don't, when they make ridiculous statements about it's the middleman. No, it's not the middleman. It's the guy who's printing money.
Exactly. And see, that's been the great divert. That's the illusionist trick. What have I got in this hand over here that can make you forget what I'm doing in this hand over here? This hand over here is printing money. This hand over here, I'm pointing at the middleman. Oh, look, it's all his fault. It's all his fault. Let me make some more money into the economy.
Well, a good magician always has a beautiful girl in a skimpy outfit.
Because, yeah, well, Janet Yellen is neither beautiful nor do I want to see her in a skimpy outfit.
But you're watching her while he's doing this and that and another thing over here with his hands.
Yes.
And even the women are looking at her.
Yeah, because so, she's usually sitting up there flashing some fan or something.
Doing this or that
doing
another thing.
Doing something else. So, Chuck, what we found out, now, it's the funny thing is, you know, John Boehner, who has presided now over $2.67 trillion, not counting this new clean debt ceiling increase, in debt increases, had what's called the Boehner rule, which meant that you would not do any debt ceiling increases without concomitant spending cuts. Really? I guess the Boehner rule doesn't apply anymore. Now, their hope, Boehner's hope, and a lot of the GOP establishment's hope, is that they can turn around and beat up the Democrats and pin this debt increase on them. Sorry, John, the buck stops with you. And you're not a Democrat, or are you?
Well,
and he's not. He's a registered Republican. But the point is, you know what? You can blame Nancy Pelosi all day long, but the people in Nancy Pelosi's district voted her in years ago, and they're going to continue to vote her in, because now what has she done? She's bringing home the bacon, which is what her constituency expects.
And
they're beating Republicans publicly on strategy. They're winning, folks. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're a Republican stalwart, and neither Chuck nor I lay claim to that. As a matter of fact, we are nonpartisan. We bash all parties equally.
All parties.
But if you're a Republican stalwart, you're getting your lunch fed to you, kids. They just, if you honestly think, and I just got an email while we're recording this, Chuck, I got an email from somebody, and I'm not going to name any names, but who's living the Republican fantasy. Oh, we can turn around in the midterm elections and pin this on them. I'm sorry, buddy.
No, we can't.
I'm sorry, buddy. Number one, you can't, because John Boehner, the buck stops with him. Number two, I want to slap the people who thought this was a good idea. You've just now opened up the checkbook for the Obama administration to spend whatever they feel like spending. You've capitulated completely, and I would say probably permanently now, Chuck, on spending cuts, because Boehner has shown a penchant, and I'm sure the next Speaker of the House will probably get lured into that same trap that Boehner let himself get led into, where having the accolades and the approval and the access to the inner circle and to the White House dinner table is more important to you than principle and the American public.
Let's talk about that for a second, because as much as I cannot stomach Newt Gingrich, and I really can't stomach
Newt Gingrich.
I get it. Newt Gingrich would not have surrendered. He would have surrendered. Don't get me wrong.
But he would have got something out of it.
He would have gotten something out of it.
And the point is, John Boehner had 199, excuse me, I counted wrong, 199 members of his own caucus who were sitting there saying, please, we're ready to go big.
Yes.
But John Boehner didn't want to go big. Now, remember, we told you, well, no, we didn't, because we were recording it yesterday and it got killed.
It got killed, yeah.
it takes 218 votes to pass a measure in the House of Representatives. That's 50% plus one. Okay, you do the math. John Boehner and 27 other Republicans, along with 199 other Republicans. What number is that, Chuck?
Mm-hmm.
226.
226.
Ooh, that's eight more than you need to pass something with just Republican support.
And you had two Democrats that got it.
And two Democrats came across the aisle, so you had 228 if you would have just held your fire.
And as we talked about, yeah,
John Boehner's biggest fear is a bad day in the press. This was political miscalculation a mile long, and I hope he pays for it.
Oh, me too.
Because if he doesn't, we certainly are. $10,000 more. That's just if you believe the Senate Republican Budget Committee staff, who are dreaming that Barack Obama is not going to take the next 13 months and only jack up our debt by a measly $1 trillion. Remember, folks, when they came here 9 months ago, yeah, I think it was 9 months ago in late spring, early summer, they wanted a $6 trillion increase in the debt ceiling. Why? They were going out and promising all the states all this money for Medicaid.
They were going to pay off governors like
John Kasich. Who originally was talking about $13 billion he was going to get in 2014. Now, it's funny how the math works out, and I've told people this before. We know the governor went after Medicaid, and he got it through the controlling board, and they increased it. It was $2.5 billion. It's about one-sixth of the amount he was asking for originally, or he was, when he gave you State of the State a year ago, said that they were going after from the federal government. Funny, the Obama administration had to settle for one-sixth of the full debt increase that they wanted 9 months ago. Do you think that's coincidence, ladies and gentlemen? I don't. See, I don't believe in chance. I don't believe in luck. I don't believe in coincidence. I believe in providence, and I believe in things that are planned. And even man can plan certain things, and this is one of them. If you think, honestly, that the debt is only going to go up by $1 trillion in the next 13 months, it's only because state governors start finding the will to nullify bad federal legislation.
And
I'm not seeing that out there.
You're not going to see that out of John Kasich.
You're not seeing it out of Chris Christie. You're not seeing it out of a number of Republican governors.
Definitely. You're definitely not going to see it out of Christie. Christie loves big government. This is what always amazed me when people were really not paying attention when he first gained national spotlight. And conservatives were saying, we need someone like Christie in the White House. Oh, yeah. Like we need another hole in the head. Like, we need Christie like I need a tumor.
Now, I got something I want to throw in here, because I think that this is humorous in one of those ironic ways. This is from an article in Breitbart.com today. Okay? titled Update, Senate Passes Clean Debt Ceiling Bill. So it's this article that was written by Jonathan Strong. But in it, he quotes Eric Cantor, who's the House Majority Leader. In other words, he's number two under John Boehner. Now, Eric Cantor also voted in favor of this debt increase. But I think it's interesting because here's this meme again, Chuck, with the political calculations. And this is the way the article sets it up. Cantor blamed the debt ceiling increase on Democrats. And here's the quote. House Republicans need more responsible and willing partners in Washington so we can finally and boldly address our long-term debt crisis, unquote, he said in a statement. Chuck, I'm holding it in now to keep from uproariously bursting out in laughter. You could take Eric Cantor's statement there and say, yeah, 199 House Republicans need more responsible and willing leadership in Washington so we can finally and boldly address our long-term debt crisis and not give away the House to our opponents without firing a shot.
Well, this is...
They've just become... John Boehner, you are now an honorary Frenchman. You have surrendered the field without firing a shot.
The cheese-eating surrender monkey.
Well, yeah, if you know Monty Python, yeah, that's right. But the point is, I'm awarding John Boehner honorary Frenchman status. And I think it's fitting because Barack Obama just had the president of France, Hollande, over here, and they spent all this money on these big dinners. Oh, that John Boehner likes to go to.
Boehner loves the state dinners.
And going to Monticello and visiting Jefferson's home and all the French influences there. I think it's fitting that the week that the French president was here in town, John Boehner decided to put on his honorary Frenchman. Ladies and gentlemen, you know what? We can't make this stuff up. This is the true sad reality of this political circus. We can't make this stuff up. The irony is so thick you can cut it with a spoon.
That brings up a Huffington Post article.
Okay.
That Paul Ryan votes against spending needed for his own budget.
Oh, yes, but this is the same Paul Ryan. Yeah, he was one of the 199 who voted no on this clean debt ceiling increase. Now, you know what? We could be charitable and say, well, he really wanted some capitulations on this, that, and the other. Now, one of the things that they talked about, Chuck, and I think this leads right into it, one of the key things that Paul Ryan, I think, supposedly said he was upset about was this reduction in veterans benefits. Now, the reduction in veterans benefits happened under the Ryan Murray budget bill.
Yes.
Okay, so his own budget cut veterans benefits. Then he turns around and demagogues it to say how horrible it was that we were cutting veterans benefits and we needed to link that to increases in the debt, but he didn't get it. So the House turned around and added it into another measure that they voted on today and passed overwhelmingly, and the Senate did too. But the increase in spending for veterans benefits is now linked to more sequester cuts that are implemented in 2024.
10
years from now, 5 election cycles from now, they'll finally pay for all of the benefit increases that they're going to be spending this year.
Okay, this is the joke that I use in my presentation on the Constitutional Convention thing on the balanced budget amendment. This is like mating elephants. It's all done at a high level. It's accomplished with a lot of roaring and screaming. And it takes 2 years to get results, or in this case,
ten. 10 years.
Yeah.
And the results are not going, and we all know what the results are going to be. We all know that looks like.
By 2024, well, you know, those spending cuts that we were going to make in 2024, we can't do that now.
Well, of course not. And they'll capitulate on those probably within the first 5 years, much less the 10.
But that makes an assumption that we've got that much time to fix this issue left.
I'm sorry, but I don't buy that.
We're going to very quickly turn a corner, I think. I hate to be one of those doomsayers that says that basically says, I actually heard somebody say the other day, we've got 2.5 years to fix such and such and so and so, or the country's over. Well, I think right now, if we don't start fixing things now, the country's over.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you start saying, well, 10 years from now, you start to sound like Ted Danson 15 years ago said, we've got 10 years left to save the planet.
Right.
Well, by golly, it's 15 years later.
Well, they were successful.
We're still here.
Planet saved.
Hey, we saved the planet. Now, and of course, I'm sure they're doing some of that.
See, that's the great thing, Chuck, about making amorphous statements that don't have any kind of hard, fast, concrete empirical measures behind it. Sort of like raising spending without any accommodations.
Yeah. Pushing off spending cuts 10 years in the future. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Like I said, ladies and gentlemen, we can't make this stuff up. I mean, all we're doing is reporting it and giving some analysis on it that, honestly, you should be able to give or think about on your own. We're just helping you to see how to put these dots together to form the picture of the clown. You remember that picture, Chuck? It's the paint-by-number picture with the clown sitting there with the tear rolling down his
cheek. Rolling down his cheek, yeah.
And honestly, they think it's funny. We think it's sad.
I could do it like my uncle painted those pictures. He painted Blue Boy, except all the colors that were supposed to be blue, he used green.
Yeah. Now, but, you know, the whole point is, again, Cantor, they're going to spend a bunch of money trying to pin all this on the Democrats. What's the Democrats going to be doing? Doling out the money that they're going to be accessing with increasing the debt and thus buying off blocks of votes just like they've done before. If you thought Obama phones were bad in 2012, wait till you see what's going to be handed out in the midterms. Can you say disaster relief in the South? Oh, we just today we're sitting here talking about pretty much the entire Mid-South is shut down because of a massive ice storm. Oh, well, look at this. We're going to roll in and do all these things, and we're going to underwrite and pay off for all these businesses that lost product and profits during this time. And we're going to go in and fix this infrastructure. And, you know, we got to do something about climate change, Charles. We're really going to have to, because it was a result of climate change that ice storms happened in the Mid-South. Not that that's ever happened in history.
Never. Oh, never. Gosh, no, no.
From Texas to the Carolinas, huh? I don't think they've ever had an ice storm.
All that
there.
Stuff in the 70s, and that had nothing to do with climate change.
No, not at all. Well, no, that was because we were freezing to death because the earth was getting colder. Now it's getting warmer. That's the reason why they can't do anything but climate change.
It's amazing to see the tap dance that gets done over this kind of stuff. And the fact is that we're going to shut down power plants now. We're going to make everybody get into cars that run on electricity that you recharge by plugging into your wall sockets. But then we're going to have to start having rolling brownouts because essentially we're closing coal-fired power plants. And we really cannot pick up the slack, no matter what anybody tells you, with solar and wind. Not going to happen. We've got, you know, all these wind farms that are at work most of the time, but they're not producing much power.
Yeah. You know what the sad part about it is, Chuck? And I mean, this is ultimately sad in multiple ways. And I'm going to preface this by saying we know full well that the solution that we're going to propose has pain attached to it.
Yep.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen. So let's not all get starry-eyed and, this pie in the sky idea that anything we do to fix our problems are going to be painless. The reason why John Boehner corralled his cardinals and his leadership team and capitulated to the Democrats to vote this clean debt ceiling increase, you know what his real rationale was? Here's the real rationale. Boehner on Tuesday morning went to the Capitol Hill Club, where the Republicans, the caucus, were meeting. They had a breakfast. They were talking about fundraising. Oh, well, amazing. They're talking about fundraising for their elections. Boehner comes up to the front of the room and basically addresses the group and says, listen, we're moving forward. Clean bill. We can't reach a deal within our own caucus, so I've got to move forward. We're going to get this done, quote unquote, Boehner continued. No strings attached. He said he's going to stop reaching for votes on the plan, and he wasn't going to even think of floating another proposal. He was going to do what he thought was best for the GOP. And why? Because the Treasury Department was saying they're within 2 weeks of defaulting. Chuck, you and I have talked about this before. We talk about it in class. I think we even mentioned on this program before. We may be at the point with over $205 trillion in true debt that a default is the only thing that's going to fix the problem.
Not just a default, repudiation.
Repudiation of the debt.
Now, explain what that means. Essentially, what it says is, you're holding a bond, we're not paying you.
We're not paying it. And again, everybody talks about geopolitics and the fact, oh, that'll make us weak. And folks, we're not a superpower anymore. Let's not kid ourselves. We have got $200 trillion in debt we're dragging around like a ball and chain. We cannot come up with anything that looks like a cohesive foreign policy under this or previous administrations. Folks, we're not a superpower, okay? We're not the world's policeman, nor should we ever have been.
Yeah, guess what? Nobody's a superpower anymore.
People nobody's, that's right, because we're all, because of our global marketplace and our global shared struggle, we're all in the global mess together.
Yeah.
Because it isn't just Greece. It isn't just third world banana republics that are defaulting. If we default on our debt, our enemies may launch militarily against us, but you know what? Where are they going to get the money to resupply? Because they're holding our debt.
Yeah, that's it. And if we
default, guess what happens to them? They default. You know what's probably going to ultimately end up happening, Chuck? It's called a reset. Somebody hit the reset button, and we have to start all of it all over again in the economy, but not just our economy, the world's economy.
Well, let me ask you a question. What happens when let's say you got a laser printer.
Yeah.
And something happens and you got to do a reset on the printer with a piece of paper in it. What do you got to do? What happens very often? Because of that fuser in there, sometimes it catches fire. This is not going to be comfortable. Any kind of a global reset means global chaos. And that's exactly really what a lot of these guys want. They want global chaos because it creates a situation where you can create a messianic figure to come forward and say, I can save you all. Or this group will come forward and say, we need global governance and a global currency in order to save you all. Now, everybody should recognize that as exceedingly dangerous.
Oh, yes.
But there will be a lot of people that bite on that idea.
Well, and they're already biting, Chuck. Like I said, I just got an email from a certain group, and they're talking about how we're going to hang this all on the Democrats. It's like they've taken the talking points from the House GOP, and they're going to go out like good little foot soldiers and try to hang John Boehner's colossal failure of leadership on somebody else.
Right.
Or as John Boehner himself put it, quote, unquote, we're not going to make ourselves the story. Oops. I'm sorry, John. Think that you failed in that task, too.
Too late.
Okay. So, honestly, and he's mad now again. So, but who are the Republicans, John Boehner and his key folks, blaming? And it's in this article that I read in the Washington Post by Chris Clazilla. I like that name. That basically, coming out of this meeting, it says a few members whispered to each other that Boehner was right, that due to conservative opposition to any hike, he was cornered. It's the Tea Party's fault, Chuck.
It's the Tea Party's
fault. It's those blankety-blank conservatives in the House who, like Jim Jordan, who was quoted as saying very clearly, we are here to fight. We are here. He says, quote, this is Jim Jordan, Ohio congressman, who was the former chairman of the House Republican Study Committee, the conservative branch.
Yep.
Quote, there's only votes for something bold. I was willing to do something bold. Well, maybe we picked the wrong Ohioan in the speaker's chair. That's all
maybe.
I got to say.
Okay, we're running out of time for today. Let's remind everybody that you and I will be teaching a class on the Constitution starting Tuesday night, March 4th.
Yes.
For those of you in the Pickerington, Canal Winchester,
Reynoldsburg, Lancaster, Canal Winchester,
Western Licking County, Newark,
Amanda,
all
those other areas.
All those areas.
We're going to be there.
Within the WLRY listening area, we're going to be teaching a class at the Cathedral of Praise Church, and that is just off Broad Street. The official address is actually posted on our website, www.principledpolicy.com. You can register for that class. You can call us to register. It is up, www.principledpolicy.com. Please sign up for that. Again, it starts Tuesday, March 4th at 7 p.m. at the Cathedral of Praise Church, just behind the old Summit Town Inn off Broad Street. It will run for 12 weeks. Again, please join us for that class. That being said, join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.